Breaking the Silence with Dr. Gregory Williams. Dr. Williams is the author of the acclaimed book, Shattered by the Darkness, Putting the Pieces Back Together After Child Abuse. Dr. Williams is on the senior leadership team at Baylor College of Medicine in Houston, Texas. And Dr. Williams travels the United States speaking and training professionals, parents, and victims about the importance of dealing with abuse and personal trauma head on and not being afraid to break the silence of your own personal pain. Feel free to call in to tonight's show at 888-627-6008 and speak with Dr. Williams and his guests live on air. And now, your host, Dr. Williams.
Good evening and welcome live from Houston, Texas, the most beautiful city in the world. Great to have you with us tonight for a live edition of Breaking the Silence, and it's just great to have you. All I have to do is do this with my head, and you can see the sun setting right here in beautiful Houston, Texas, over the Texas Medical Center, and I love that view, and that sold me on this place when I walked in and I saw the view. I thought, I got to have this, and just love being here and get to share that with you, and just welcome to the show tonight. We have, I want to guarantee you, a money-back guarantee tonight of the guest that we have this evening that has not only his own story to tell, but he has the resources of an organization that probably has some of the most awesome resources out there, and a family that we want to invite you to be a part of and to get involved with. And that's what I love about that. We'll talk all about that here shortly with the organization that he's with, but that they invite people to get involved. That's what they are all about. It's not about patting themselves on the back. It's about helping other people get up and walk the journey with them. And I love those type of people. And I'll tell you what, it'll be a good program. Next week, we have Lisa Zarconi. She is a member up in the Massachusetts area of this same organization. So I'm just kind of finding a new group of friends and sharing them with you. And that's one thing I like about this program is that we've, number one, been on going on 2 years. We've just passed our over 100th show. And it's just wonderful each and every week. August, we have a fantastic lineup for the whole month of August. So you want to make sure that Lisa Zarconi's next week. And then the first month, first week in August is Michael Pritchard out of California. And he's with the California Counseling Consortium there. I've done some speeches for them and a great group of people. And he's going to be in share with us the first week in August. And the second week of August, where's the book? Second week of August will be from the movie Mrs. Doubtfire, Lisa Jacob. She was the oldest daughter of Robin Williams and Sally Field in Mrs. Doubtfire movie. And also, what other movie was she in? Several other movies. I'm going brain dead on the other one. But just a wonderful interview we had with her. And we're going to share that with you the second Sunday night in August. So looking forward to it. But tonight, I got to get my phone up, make sure everything's up and running. Looks like we are live on Facebook. My son is there taking care of that. Tonight, we have a special guest all the way from Los Angeles, California, Bill Murray. He is not only a survivor of childhood sexual abuse, but I want to tell you what, he's going to tell his story tonight, share with whatever he wants to share about that story. But I think more importantly, that because of that experience, because of the need for people needing resources and help, he founded the NAASCA. And I want you to write that down because there's a website. So write this down, NAASCA.org. And when we go to a commercial, on our first commercial, everybody jump on there, join them, like them, favorite them or what those things are that you do on their web pages and Facebooks and all that. But just start looking at that and bookmark that page. And then later on, or a night you can't sleep, or maybe a time you need some help, get on there. You're going to find some wonderful resources, but probably more impactful, wonderful people. And that's what life is all about. And Bill launched that several years ago. I think he designed the website. Is that right, Bill? Fantastic website. But he's got a story. And instead of me sharing his story, I just want to welcome Bill Murray from Los Angeles with us tonight. Bill, can you hear me okay tonight?
Oh, yeah. It's perfect. It sounds great. I hope you can hear me too. Okay.
Do you get the sun like this in California?
Satellite disk?
No, the sun.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's my sun. It's coming through at a much more severe angle.
Okay.
And I closed the window over here because it was on my face. So, yeah, we get sun.
Okay. All right. I know. California's beautiful. Well, welcome to the program tonight. And it's great to finally put a face to the name. We have crossed paths on several different radio shows. Matter of fact, I think I'm on somebody's show Thursday night with one of your groups with a radio interview. Darlene? I think that's going to be July 28th, which will be a week from Wednesday night, I believe, something like that. But anyway, it's great. Everybody that I've met with your group has just been wonderful. Tell me right up front, before we go into your own story, Bill, what is the longest lettered organization in the country? What's all that stand for? NAASCA. What does all that mean?
We're the National Association of Adult Survivors of Child Abuse.
Wow.
Adult survivors of child abuse, everybody understands ASCA, but there were already groups with ASCA in it. And so I know we'll be national. And I just chose National Association. So NASCA.org. Yeah.
What's your purpose? What's your goals?
At the time that I launched NASCA, I'd been looking for something myself. I was 25 years in recovery already, so I was seriously in recovery. But I was looking for a new venue for me. I was in Florida, actually, and I was looking for a new place for me to go where I could interact with people and so forth, which we'll get into later because I think that's a huge element of this. Yes. But I couldn't find anything that I was happy with for various reasons. Some of the organizations were too constrictive. You had to be this and you couldn't be that. Or some were too religious and you had to be this religion only. Some were only men. There were a lot of restrictions, in other words. And I was looking for a place that was as comfortable as could be for every survivor and that would allow people to find themselves, not tell them what they have to do, but tell them what they can do and guide them and help them into whatever process they were going to have. Well, that ended up being NASCA because I couldn't find an organization that was similar to the one I would like to have found. So I created it.
That's wonderful. If you can't find it, make it yourself. People will come. Yeah, that's great. That's been going how many years, Bill?
Well, it's about 2008 or 9 I started. And I had built websites before. So the actual building of a website, although this is a better website than some of the others, you know, I wasn't afraid of that. I'm not making any pretense about me being a whiz bang at technology, but I can get it done. I can make it look clean. And actually, I think it helps me that the NASCA website appears like a community site. It's not out of the box, kind of website. It's built, it's handmade, in other words. And the NASCA website now has many, many pages, all kinds of tools. I think there's 30 different services and tools. All of them are free. That's another thing. Some of the organizations that I found were very expensive. And, you know, I didn't feel like a newcomer, which I related to as being, at least in the past, a newcomer, had enough money to really engage in those kinds of places. You know, what we needed was something that was at least cheaper. And so NASCA doesn't charge anything. We are a nonprofit organization with no funding. We depend on the personal contributions of our membership, and it's really occasional. It's not very much. But we have no dues or fees and no registration either. You're a member of NASCA if you say you are, in other words. And you're a member of NASCA because you've been with us before. And so we call it a member of the NASCA family. And we really try to make it feel like a family. So the newcomer, however they engage with us, it might be on our radio show, or it might be on our website or our Facebook page or whatever. We have all those things. Once they put their toe in the water, they start to feel right away that they are welcomed, that there is no exclusion. There's nobody that can't be a part of NASCA. The mission statement is so simple. We deal with sexual assault, violent or physical abuse, emotional trauma, and neglect in any combination. Even if it happened only once to you, if you're traumatized by it in your adulthood, you're in. So we don't measure each other's trauma, and neither do we measure each other's recovery. We know that some people are further along in their journey, but others, whoever are brand new, are welcomed, and they're not admonished because they haven't done any work yet. No, instead they're encouraged because we validate them. You know, as soon as they come in, we validate them. We know that the feelings they're having are real, and that there's a reason they had them. We know that the secrecy that they've kept was done for a real reason, and because we've done it ourselves. So yeah. A lot of it is survivors talking to survivors, or survivor professionals talking to survivors, and you know, it's doing very well. We have I don't know, tens of thousands of members, but I don't know how many, because we're not registering anybody. You know, so the only reason we need your email address really is if you want our newsletter. That's it.
Well, you know, it's great. I contacted you when I first wrote my first book. As it was coming out, I contacted probably one of the most well-known organizations that does training for people that have been sexually abused, and they go into the places to train. I thought, okay, hey, when I'm out speaking, I would love to promote them, hand out their resources. I was willing to buy their resources to hand out free to the people. And I called two or three times, wrote two or three emails, sent them a couple books. And the only thing I ever heard back from them was emails. And I still get an email once a week, every Tuesday, asking for money. It's like, wait, I feel like I've been abused again. That's not what I wanted to promote you, help you, and you help me, but not financially. Why is it everybody always wants something? And that's what I love about your organization. Hey, you're just part of the family. And it's right. Everybody that I've ran across in NASCA has been supportive, loving, caring, applauding each other, lifting each other up, and just encouraging and rooting on. And it doesn't get any better than that. And everybody needs a group of people like that behind them and stand along with them.
Yeah, I want you to be as involved as you will be, because your message and mine are very similar. At least what you just said really resonates with me as why I do what I do and how I do it. You know, I modeled it after my own recovery process, but not of the recovery part, but of the traditions of a 12-step program.
Yeah.
And because my recovery was based on the 12 traditions, I mean, the 12 steps, but we don't recommend any particular path for a person. We recommend them all. And so we know that there's many, many ways to get into, into healing. It could be ministry. It could be psychiatry. It could be sociology. It could be psychology. It could be life coaches. You know, it could be, and 12-step groups, of course, and other groups that have their own sort of system. And then there's many tools. So if it's EMDR or hypnosis or it's yoga or animal therapy, whatever mixture, we explain all these things to people, in other words, and we allow them to make their own choices. We don't tell them what they have to do. We say, whatever appeals to you, get started. And if you find something else, then add that to it. And if you don't like it after a while, change to something else. But we don't judge them for that. We know that, you know, it's more powerful if they make the choice and they make the commitment to whatever it is they choose.
Was you always that open-minded about that, Bill? When I came into it, I was a little more closed-minded. I knew what helped me, and I tried to push what helped me, and I still write about what helped me. But then when I started getting people on the show, they would talk about meditation. They would talk about mindfulness. They would talk about yoga. It's like, wait, nah. But then I started seeing the impact that it had on other people. It's like, wait, just because it doesn't work for me doesn't mean it can't be helpful for you.
Sure.
Is your interaction with all these thousands of people in Nazca open and expanded your mind of what helps and what, you know, people have available to them?
Well, like I said, we don't follow the 12 steps. We don't promote the 12 steps, but we do follow the 12 traditions. They are the spiritual principles by which an organization can run. And I've run all my organizations that I've ever had since the mid 80s against the 12 traditions, because that's what I loved about AA. I didn't love the steps. I didn't want to do the steps. But the traditions are really a beautiful tool. They're on our website, yep. Modified to talk about recovery from trauma as opposed to recovery from alcohol. And they really work very well. It's a singleness of purpose that's most important. The only thing we do is help people recover. and the second thing, we do two things. We educate the public. So that's one. And we help each other recover. That's it. And there's no outside issues that are brought in. We don't talk politics. We don't talk religion. We don't talk. I mean, we touch on these things. But the religious people, for example, and we have a lot of spiritual people, religious people, there's no problem with saying my path included going to my church and committing myself to even to Jesus, as long as you're not telling somebody they have to.
Right.
So that's the difference. And it's we have atheists and we have agnostics and we have every kind of person. We have Jews and we have Muslims, and because it doesn't matter what your religion is, you know, it matters that you have an honest desire to recover from the trauma of your youth. That's all. And whatever path you take, is it going to be okay with us?
Yeah, and I tell you, I think sexual abuse and surviving that, I think over the years since I have come out and told, which has only been a few years ago, and then we come back from the break, we'll hear about your story, but I have found out that it's not prejudice. It hits every race, every economic class, every neighborhood, every belief system, every organization. People look at some places and go, oh, the Boy Scouts or all of this or all this. No, it's been everywhere where there's a group of people or a single home. It affects so many people. I don't even think we have a clue of how many people it affects. I think we still are the tip of the iceberg on breaking open this huge wound that, at least in our country, probably, and I know around the world, dealing with.
It's worldwide.
Absolutely.
I mean, the best estimates that I could come up with are about 60 million American adults who were sexually abused when they were kids. And that's a huge number. And we only deal with a very small percentage of that, you know, perhaps 10% of that. And of the 10% that we're able to reach and they get into recovery, they don't stay necessarily. Maybe 50% of them stay and actually have long-term recovery. So the number of people that are healing is very small compared to the number of people who are damaged, because this doesn't go away. This trauma doesn't go away. It lasts your life, really, in different ways. Although there are many techniques and tools that can be used to lessen the impact and to increase the likelihood that you'll have a comfortable life and a full life, which is what I have. I don't have a big bank account or even a fancy car. I just have a happy life. that's what I was after, and that's what I got.
Yeah.
We promise an improvement. We don't say what people are going to get. Depends on how hard they work, because it is work.
Yeah.
But it's a lot better to be in recovery, even floundering around a bit, and but know you're amongst others that are doing the same thing than it is to be out there alone with no hope, you know, with feeling responsible for whatever happened to you, which is not true, and being ashamed, so ashamed that you can't talk about your story.
Wow, that's so true. And I spent 50 plus years walking that journey alone,
right?
And making excuses. And on the other side of this first break, I really want to just, when we come back, just say, hey, Bill, tell us your story, because you have one. And I'm going to let you just go as deep as you want to. But we'll do that. If you want to get involved, 888-627-6008. 888-627-6008. We would love to hear from you. BBS Radio staff will pick up the phone and say hello and bring you right in. But when we get back, we will listen and hear the story of Bill Murray from Los Angeles, California, right after this first commercial break. Hang with us. Finally coming very soon will be the release of my second book in the three-part trilogy, Overcoming the Darkness, The Roadmap to Hope. Now, this book will be an in-depth look at the many different facets and emotions that a person goes through when they're experiencing anxiety and trauma in their life, and they're simply searching for hope. And an exciting addition to this book will be a companion journal guide that will come along with it. Also, there's going to be something that I'm very excited about, the youth version of this book called When Dark Clouds Come, The Roadmap to Hope. And it's going to be an excellent tool and guide for teenagers dealing with stress in their lives. So stay tuned for the release date coming very, very soon for these exciting new resources. Now back to Breaking the Silence with Dr. Gregory Williams on the BBS Radio Network. Welcome back. It's great to have you back here live in Houston, Texas. We have with us tonight from the beautiful city of Los Angeles, California, Bill Murray, and he is the founder, not just a member, the founder of NAASCA. And we're going to find out a little bit more about that, but I want to make sure you write those letters down, .org, and that'll get you right to their website. Bill, tell me, and I've read a little bit, I've heard from some people, your story, but it's always better just to eyeball. Whatever you'd like to share, but how young were you? What happened? How did it affect? How long was you silent? There's so many questions I always have, but I'm just going to kind of let you tell it in your way. What happened in your life?
Well, what happened in my life was I was brought up in a very Irish Catholic family and very Catholic. One summer, my parents decided to send me to a summer camp that was indeed a Catholic camp, you know, so that Bill would have a nice time between school years. Yeah. I was 11 or 12 when I went. I spent a month there. And within a few days, one of the counselors approached me, and he was the he was in charge of the swimming pool. It was an Olympic-sized swimming pool, and he approached me in the shower, walked up behind me, reached over me inside my bathing suit, and held on to my testicles and said, "Wow, these are really nice rocks," or something like that. And I froze. So you either do three things: you freeze, or you fight, or you what's the other one?
Flight. You fly.
Or you run, right?
Yeah.
And I froze. I turned into a statue. You know, I didn't know what was going on. And then what happened was, over the process of the month that I was staying there, he introduced me to more, and he groomed me and introduced me to more and more activities by offering me the use of his cameras. He was a photographer for the place too, and he had nice cameras, like Nikon cameras and big lenses and the dark room and all that. And a lot of it happened in the dark room, at least at first, where you can like close the door and turn on the red light out there and nobody's supposed to come in. And, you know, I was shocked. I didn't even know what the word sex meant. I didn't know what any of this was. And when the year ended, he showed me he took photographs of me, thousands and thousands of pornographic photographs over a 3-year period, because that's how long I knew him, in all kinds of positions and poses and situations and even different locales and so forth. And in the process of doing that, he did show me some little boy magazines, basically, that were naked little boys that were featured in a magazine that was often sold in a piece of like plastic. I think it was under the counter of the bookstores and stuff. I don't know. But he showed me these, and it was obvious. What he was telling me was, you know, your pictures could show up in here, you know, that kind of thing. It was like a warning, which is another thing pedophiles do. They threaten you in one way or another. I'm going to hurt your sister. I'm going to kill your cat. You know, I'm going to tell on you and your life will be terrible and all these things. So the second year, I had found out what being a, quote, faggot or being a gay, a homo was on the playground, because I had no access to any other information. And of course,
back in those days, Bill, we didn't know any of that stuff, right?
I learned it all along.
We didn't know any of that.
None, nothing. Had no idea what this was. So, but I did know that there was something really bad about it. That I knew.
Yeah.
Because you weren't supposed to say, you know, well, I'm gay. No, you'd get beat up or whatever, you know. So I in my third year there, he invited me. He went to my parents, who he knew, because he gave a bunch of legitimate pictures to them every year, which were fine photography. He was very good. You know, of me at the campsite, me in the swimming pool, me on the horseback. And those were wonderful. And my parents loved it. And he said, you know, I'm going on a vacation. He taught high school in the school year. He said, I'm going on vacation and I'll be gone 2 or 3 weeks. And I'm going to go see Expo 67, which was a kind of a World's Fair thing in Montreal. And he said, you know, if Bill would like to go along, I got plenty of room in my car. You could come along and see the Expo 67. They go, oh, isn't that wonderful of you, brother? You know, that would be great. And so the long and the short of it is they put me on a bus, went up to New York City. He met me at the Port Authority and for the first time was relieving the Port Authority. He unzipped his own pants. I'd never seen him naked. And pulled out his penis and shoved my head down in his lap. And I was shocked. I already knew him 3 years. And I'd never been required to even look at him, much less touch him or do anything to him. I was always like the object of him. So the next 2 or 3 weeks were horrible, because I kept refusing to do stuff. And he was trying to, in effect, traffic me to other couples, an older man and a young boy. And he played with me all over the city. And of course, I didn't even know where I was. They didn't even have 911 numbers back there.
So you were being trafficked, or he was attempting to?
He was attempting to, and I was refusing. So he was bringing me to situations where he wanted to kind of trade me for the other boy, and I refused to do it. And of course, that stopped the engagement. But I'd say he did that about 5 times, some of them in Manhattan, one of them in a summer camp, actually 2, in another southern camp that we visited in Vermont, which was a kind of a nudist colony for little boys. And we went to a lean-to spend the night camping. And there were 2 other men with their boys with him. So 5 or 6 times he tried to do this with me, and I kept refusing. And fortunately, he was not a violent person. He was pissed, but he was not violent. And so I was lucky that I found I was in with a pedophile that didn't take advantage of the fact that I was, you know, as a stall.
Yeah.
You know, he was an older man. He could have done anything he wanted to me. And this is what happens to a lot of kids. My pedophile even got stopped on the way up to Montreal on the thruway by a cop, a state trooper. And he looked in the window and he said, where are you guys going? And the priest to the brother gave him a story that he believed. And he sent us off. I didn't say anything. I didn't know what to do. I was sitting on the front seat next to the brother, like, you know, shaking. And here was a chance for me to say something to a cop, but I didn't. And instead, I went home a couple of days. He only took me to Montreal for one night so that he could stand me in front of some of the exhibits and take pictures and prove that we'd been there. He took me back to the Port Authority I went back home, and a week later, I attended for the first time a minor seminary. Now that's a seminary for high school age boys that were thinking about the priesthood, and this was Benedictine, and I had asked to go there. So this was a goal of mine. And as I said, I was extremely Catholic, and you know, one of the options available to a boy. I mean, I did all the altar boy stuff and all that stuff, every sacrament and all, was to think about priesthood. And my parents were delighted that I was thinking about it. Sure. And it was my first kind of inkling that might be a career path for me. So I ended up, long story short, I ended up going to this school for 4 years and graduating from there as a high school student. But I went for, it was 1967, 68, 69, 70, and I was in the class of 71. And so those were the years we're talking about. And when I first got there, I had all these stories inside of me, right? This, all of what had happened had never been discussed by anybody, with anybody. One of the priests there pulled me aside and said, have you ever had any homosexual experiences? Which I denied. I was shocked. Why would he think that? No, you know. He asked me a second time, and it was again, no. But the third time, I thought, maybe this is a chance for me to get help. And so I agreed to meet him, and I went to his room, and he gave me absolution. He gave me a confession, which is a huge deal for Catholics. It's one of the sacraments where you tell your transgressions, and essentially your sins are forgiven. The priest is a representative of Jesus or God and gives you some penance perhaps and so forth. But after confession, if you've been given an honest confession, your soul has been cleaned basically. And so I told him the whole story, and I told him it took 3 hours, 2 or 3 hours. And every little nuance that he wanted to answer, I did. And I felt relieved. Oh, thank God, I'm getting help. But unfortunately, about 10 days, 2 weeks later, he himself turned out to be interested in me sexually. And he told another priest, who told a brother, who told an upperclassman. And essentially, I spent two of the first of the 4 years, you know, defending myself from, they must have told each other, from other predators. And in the junior and senior year, I was big enough to, I mean, I was mad. I was big enough to fend them off. They were not going to come near me because they could tell, you know, they would be in trouble. And he wasn't the only one. There were other priests and brothers too. Another one who was my Latin teacher, and I was required to have 2 years of Latin. I was horrible at languages, but it wasn't because I'm not smart. It was because this guy was my Latin teacher, and he would stand behind me at a study hall, leaning over me, just like the brother. And reached down over me, and he kind of grabbed one hand and put it and just hold it like this while he's watching my notebook and he's watching me read and so forth. But he's actually pushing his hand down into my lap so he can touch my penis. And he'd stand there for forever. And of course, any male that in his teenage years who you do that to is going to get an erection, obviously. So anyway, these were horrible experiences. And when I got out of there, there was no way I was going to continue to pursue priesthood, at least not then. And I went to a secular college, the University of Toronto, and I put all this, I thought, behind me. I started dating girls. I didn't know anything about girls. I'd been in an enclosed situation in the high school setting where it was all boys. And, you know, I learned a little bit about girls. I learned about how to play guitar. That was really good. And mostly what I learned was how to drink. And boy, drinking was it. Drinking was the resolution. I felt great when I had a few beers and then a few more and then a few more. And, you know, college is perfect for that. Toronto, like all of Canada, is huge on beer drinkers, but also pubs and bars and so forth. And frankly, I didn't care what was offered me. As long as it was offered me, I was going to drink it. I kind of did poorly, enough so that I felt like I should drop out and reassess. In the third year, I dropped out, went back to New York City where I was from. And this time I went to school. I went and worked in a bar. I worked in a real estate office and so forth, but I was just bumming around trying to feel what I wanted to do. I went to NYU and I studied film, television, and journalism. And I had been working in the film industry as a production manager and so forth. So I had an idea. I wanted to be in film and TV. So that's my pursuit. And I actually had a choppy career, but I did have a career in that, which is why I ended up in Los Angeles. But, you know, it took me until I got to Los Angeles to find an effective way to let the story out. And it didn't come out because I was seeking recovery from trauma. It came out because I was trying to get sober. And I showed up at an AA meeting for somebody's recommendation. And in the process, I fell in with a group that allowed me to talk about these things, which was unusual at the time. It was the mid-80s, and they had a singleness of purpose in AA, which is only talk about drinking, but they were starting to see people who had drug use like I did and other things in there, and they would let it be a little looser. Well, when I shared, they said, you're as sick as your secrets, which is an expression I still use today with people. Yeah. And I knew what my secret was. The secret, right, was that story. And a little bit at a time, I started to let pieces of it out. And fortunately, I fell in with a group. I didn't know I had, but a group of people whose elders like took me aside and say, you know, you're not supposed to talk about this stuff, but we can certainly see how the things that you went through led you to a life of drinking. And it really affected who you became. So you go ahead and talk about it if you want, because we don't know what it means, but we also know that there might be new people coming in after you who don't know what it means, and they need to hear you. So they gave me permission. And, you know, I took it. You know, I would share a little bit here and a little bit there and a little bit here. Got a sponsor I could share it all with. You know, I spoke at conventions and all that. Anyway, this was the process that I went through, and I had tried other things. You know, the rape hotline, people didn't want to hear me. I was the enemy. You know, Planned Parenthood didn't want to see me. I was the enemy. There was no recovery for boys. In fact, it wasn't even acknowledged that boys could be sexually abused. And so nobody wanted me. Boy, it was tough. But AA became my home. And it was 25 years of recovery until I made the decision to start NASCA, which is now 12 or 13 years old, which is why, you know, we're like 38 or 39 years. I'm 38 or 39 years in recovery, and NASCA is like 12 or 13.
That's amazing. Did you remember during those days you started drinking, did you drink just to drink, or did you deliberately drink to numb the pain, the hurt?
Well, that's in effect what happens. I don't know that the alcoholic really, you know, it's not a process. In fact, when you start drinking and if you're attracted to drinking, and there are a lot of people who are, not everybody who drinks is an alcoholic, but right. I was. And the reason is because I loved drinking. I loved what it brought me. Not even the taste, but the sense of who I became. I, for the first time, was able to live with Bill, except wow. Bill. You know, and my story, I would let it out. You know, when I'd let it out mostly with girls, because I learned that once I had gone to NYU, I was in my mid-20s by then, but I'd learned that telling your story, your trauma story, can get you sex. And so I was telling pieces of my trauma story to girls because I was very interested in learning more about girls, and they were fine. It wasn't like I was taking advantage of them. This was the era of sex, love, and rock and roll, right? Sex, drugs, and rock and roll. And we, you know, there was a lot of sexuality. But I had none. So I did use portions of my story to earn someone's sort of sympathy enough to give me, you know, maybe sympathy sex or whatever. And frankly, you know, I don't feel I took advantage of them because they knew what they were doing and they would have said no if they didn't want it. But yeah, it was because it let me feel for the first time like someone that was worthy of walking on this earth. You know, I was crap. I was mud until that. And so it is the sense of, what am I trying to say? It's the effect. Yeah. The effect of drinking that I was after. And of course, once you're an alcoholic and you drink for effect, you drink beyond effect. And yeah, so there's no such thing as stopping once you've started. You can't predict what night your six pack is going to be enough and what night you're going to have to do Hennessy and vodka and Coke and whatever else to do
right,
it too.
Right. Know?
So, yeah.
Okay. But tell you what, we're going to take our last commercial break. And when we come back from this, I want to kind of turn the corner from your story of then developing. You kind of touched on it a little bit, but what you found a great help with, what gave you hope, how you made it through those dark times, if there were dark times, how long were you quiet? Just a lot of things as we progress to where you are today. But we'll talk more about that, and we're going to drill a little bit deeper just on the other side of this break. 888-627-6008. We would love to get you involved. It looks like there's some comments coming up on Facebook now. Feel free to get involved, and we'll see you right back right after this last commercial break. We'll be right back.
HCI Publishing, that brought you the international bestsellers A Child Called It and the Chicken Soup for the Soul series, comes the latest book by Dr. Gregory Williams, Shattered by the Darkness. This book describes the horrific abuse that Dr. Williams suffered at the hands of his father for over 12 years, and the damaging effect of keeping everything silent about that abuse for 30 years. If you're looking for that book that you can't put down, then pick up a copy of Shattered by the Darkness by Dr. Gregory Williams at all Barnes & Noble stores, Amazon, and Books A Million. Now, back to Breaking the Silence with Dr. Gregory Williams.
Shattered by the Darkness, and still do. This week it went to like number 19. I don't know who's buying this thing, but it's been out about 2 or 3 years, and it still is doing well. So thank you for supporting that, and I can't wait till the next two books come out. And hopefully, thanks for your patience on that. It's been it's hard to write, so I'm trying not to be too rough and take my time with it. We're with Bill Murray from Los Angeles, California, and he just shared his story, and thank you for the rawness of that. And did it always come that easy for you, Bill? I know you said maybe sometimes you shared it with dates and girlfriends and things, but when did you realize that, or do you believe that breaking that silence is a huge step in recovery, in healing? What's your view of that?
Well, it's not just breaking your silence, but it's breaking your silence in appropriate settings. So I'd say the things with the girls, that wasn't going to give me any help. It would give me some sexual experiences, but they weren't going to put me into healing. But, you know, so I'm just differentiating between just telling your story, because some people will tell their story and tell their story, and they'll get on the rooftop and tell their story, and it's not working. You know why? That's not where you're supposed to tell your story. You need to tell your story in the company of perhaps somebody who's gone through it themselves, perhaps a counselor that's trauma-informed, you know, maybe your minister from your church, something where you have a partnership in this, and hopefully with somebody who has their own experience, strength, and hope that they can transmit back to you. So yes, you are as sick as your secrets, but telling your secret needs to be done in a setting that's appropriate to helping you. And there are some that are not, that's all I'm saying. However, tell your story. Oh yeah. I mean, that's the problem. The solution is telling when the problem is silence, you know. So
how did it affect you, Bill, when you told your story and then it became a tool to have it happen again, or at least the tinge of it, the borderline of it? Well, it was abuse when he's reaching down at the school desk on you. How did that go? Hey, wait, telling the story is not such a great idea. How did that affect you ended up coming out and telling people about what happened when the first time or two it backfired?
Well, this was in recovery in AA. I decided I would tell my parents. I had gone to their house and I'd slipped up by saying some, "Oh, those priests are all gay anyway. What do they know?" or something. And my mother said, "What?" So we met at a psychiatrist's office, and we met about four times. My girlfriend at the time, who became my wife and mother of my child later, now my ex-wife, but and me and my mom, dad, and the shrink. And we all went to this neutral guy in Manhattan, who nobody knew. And I told my story. I chose to do it that way because I was afraid my father was going to have a heart attack. And he very nearly did. And I told the story, I think, about four times. Or we had four sessions because there were questions from my parents and so forth that needed to be answered. But I'll tell you what, the psychiatrist had no idea what to do with me. There was no recovery offered. So it was, but it was, this is an example of, at least it was a setting that I designed this setting so that it was appropriate and would be less likely to be damaging, especially to my parents, who they were not my perpetrators, although that's true in a lot of cases. In fact, that's the biggest group of predators is family and extended family. Mine were in the second biggest group, which is, I call it the caregiver group. Now that can include priests and Boy Scout masters and, you know, the school teachers coach and all that, you know, or babysitters. So mine was in that second category, about 30%, whereas yours, for example, I understand was your dad. So that'd be part of the 60% that make up that group. And really less than 10% are strangers. It's very small. That's the only thing we teach, though, is stranger danger. Yeah. But anyway, the point is that sure enough, my father was able to make it through, heard all the stories, and I made a promise to myself that because I saw how much it affected them, I would not tell my story in public until they were gone.
I did
say. That's why it took 25 years, because I saved my sharing in meetings with sponsors, in conventions, even closed conventions and things like that, speaking engagements. I talked about it, but I didn't go public. I didn't write a book or anything like that because
out of respect for your parents.
Yeah. I was afraid. Yes. I didn't want to hurt them anymore. That they were hurt. Oh my God. They were so Catholic, you know, the church let them down too, just like it let me down. But anyway, the point is that I waited. My father died in 1999, just before the turn of the century. My mother in 2009 and my sister in 2005. So my whole family was gone in 2009. Was roughly when I started looking for a place where I could go myself that was a public thing. And I couldn't find anything that I felt was appropriate for me. There were too many restrictions or too many requirements or whatever it was. And so I launched NASCA. I made it up from a compilation of many things. But, you know, what I had understood as being important for me became what NASCA is. So there was no big deal about somebody's recovery was not more important than anybody else's, for example, and all kinds of trauma were included, and every sexual proclivity. So we have transsexuals and we have homosexuals and so forth, and every ethnic background, every religious background, everybody's included. Every color skin. I mean, we're black, brown, yellow, green, and purple. You know, and we're all family, and that's how we treat each other. So the traditions and the guidelines that we set up assure that that no one person can dominate, but that everybody can participate. And there are a lot of protections. There's anonymity, which is part of AA. If you need it, you have it. If you don't need it, then you don't need it. But we came up with a pretty good organization, and it's now,
yes.
I don't know, it's all free, by the way. I don't know if right. I said this before.
Yeah. Tell about your radio show. When and how can people, because a lot of the people who listen to this show love podcasting and listening in. What's the best way to get in touch and hear your show?
Well, the website will tell you all this, because the front page of the website is the hub for everything we do. So NASCA.org is designed so that you can find almost anything. And when you click on it, you go there, but the front page doesn't close. So it opens in a different tab. And when you close that tab, you're back at the front page. So you can't get lost. And again, that's a design feature that I started. I mean, I didn't want newcomers to get lost, you know?
Yeah.
So anyway, there's a front page article on that, or a series on that. We have five nights a week. We have shows 5 nights a week. That's Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday, all the weeknights at 8 o'clock Eastern. So that's 5 o'clock Pacific. They're 90-minute shows, and they are, all people who we schedule. So we schedule speakers, and we schedule special guests who are hyphenates, we call them. They're people who have a professional background, but they're also survivors. Twice a week we have that. 3 times a week, someone tells their story. And then we have 3 recovery meetings a week too, which are done on Zoom. And they are not recorded. They are anonymous meetings. If you want to be anonymous, you can be.
Is it a topic on the Zooms, or just kind of an open forum? You have a person that kind of facilitates starts talking about something, and other people jump in?
Right. We have three different meetings, and each one has its own facilitator. But they kind of guide the group, and there are some very loose rules. It's pretty much somebody can bring something to the group, and it'll be discussed until it feels like everybody's had a chance to say what they want. And then the facilitator will say, well, did anybody bring anything else? You know, just go on. These are not recorded, so you have to be there for them. But that's because these are what we call recovery meetings. They're not shows.
I'll tell you what, Bill, we only got like a minute left, but I'll tell you, 5 nights a week, you're putting out an hour and a half worth of programming each night of Monday through Friday, plus your Zooms.
Another hour and a half.
NASCA is really pouring in a lot of resources just in amongst themselves with the family, and that is so awesome. If somebody wants to get in touch with you before we close out tonight, what's the best way? Is it through the website, or is there an email that they can tab into you directly?
They'll find my email address all over the website. And we have contact lists with other people. Almost everybody at NASCA knows who I am, and anybody can contact me. But it's a version of my name, which is B. Murray III, 3RD. At AOL.com, but you'll find this on the website all over the place. Also the contact list and the ambassador list and the list of volunteers. These are all people that let me put their phone number and an email address on the site in public so that other people can call them, because that's what we do. Yeah. We support each other. So it's all volunteers. None of us are paid. There's no dues or fees. We never charge for anything. All our programs are free, and we design them that way. So
that's great work, Bill. I appreciate you sharing your story tonight. I mean, we're out of time. They're getting ready to cut me off, but I appreciate you being with me. I appreciate even more being part of your family with NASCA, and I can't wait to meet Lisa Zarconi next week and other people I've already met and had on the program. I just appreciate it so much. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you so much for the invitation. It was my privilege.
Okay, Bill. Thank you. We always like to close out each show, each week, each and every week, no matter what you've gone through, no matter what you're going through right now, no matter what you're going to face tomorrow. I always want to let you know before we go tonight, there's always hope. Always hope. Join us right here next week, live from Houston, Texas, 8 p.m. Central Time for another edition next week with Lisa Zarconi of Breaking the Silence. God bless. Have a great week. Good night.
Thank you for listening to Breaking the Silence with Dr. Gregory Williams. To contact Dr. Williams, dial 832-396-6525 or email him at shatteredbythedarkness@gmail.com. And don't forget to join us each Sunday night at 8 p.m. Central Time, 6 p.m. Pacific on BBS Radio Station 1 for the next episode of Breaking the Silence.